Good afternoon. My name is Rick, and I'm an alcoholic. Let's open the meeting followed with the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And so welcome to the Emotional Sobriety Workshop. And what we're going to do, so Monty and I have made some notes because we're calling a panel slash workshop. If I was just a speaker, I would just normally speak. And actually, when we came up with this idea, I thought Monty was going to, I was just going to be the chair and introduce him, but he wouldn't let me get away with that. He said I have to share some also. So again, welcome to the Emotional Sobriety Workshop. And I'd like to Yuma, which is sometimes referred to as the Canada's southernmost city, especially with all our Canadian visitors, which we're really, really glad to have. So this topic comes from a letter in Language of the Heart. And if you haven't read it, I really recommend the book. It comes from the article of Bill's The Next Frontier, Emotional Sobriety, which he wrote in about 1958, I think it was, where he had 24 years of sobriety when he wrote this anyway. And it starts out by saying, I think many Ulsters who have put our AA booze cure to severe but successful test still find that they often lack emotional sobriety, you know? And Monty and I both have over 40 years, and I can tell you it's true in my case. I'll let him talk for himself. And the other thing I think, and Bill goes on, he goes on to talk about it a lot more. In fact, I'll read a little bit more. He says, how to translate right mental conviction into right emotional result and to into safe, happy, and good living, which I think he's referring to as his emotional sobriety. Well, that's not just a neurotic problem. It's a problem of life for itself, for all of us who have gotten to the point of real willingness and how to write principles into all our affairs. And then, you know, when I was thinking of doing this or kind of trying to prepare a little bit for the workshop, I do one of my readings every day is the Daily Reflections. And yesterday, as I was working on this, here's the Daily Reflection. It's convincing Mr. Hyde. Even as we you away, peace and joy may still elude us. That's the place many of us oldsters have come to, and it's a hell of a spot. Literally, how shall our unconscious, from which so many of us fears and compulsions and phony aspiration stream, be brought into line with what we actually believe, know, and want? How to convince our dumb, raging, and hidden Mr. Hyde becomes our main task. And, you know, I don't know, things just seem to be coincidental or, right? And that was actually a part of what I was going to put in I'd already identified that I was going to put in my talk. And then I read it the day while I'm actually working on putting the talk together. So I'm supposed to be here. I don't know about the rest of you, but the other. And then today's, we do a meditation, my wife and I, every morning, reading and meditation. And the meditation was on maintaining emotional sobriety by being calm. So again, this is something I'm supposed to be doing. I hope maybe it helps somebody out there. You know, when Bill talks about the bumps in sobriety, or about, that we have found a booze cure, I think, personally, what he's saying is we've learned to get through the big stuff, you know? It's the little stuff that can get us, and I've heard that around AA meetings, too. And, you know, in my own personal life, I flew in Alaska and just absolutely loved my job up there. And then for medical reasons, I couldn't do it anymore. And I was over 30 years sober when that happened. And I was so upset that I actually called a sponsor and said, let's go to dinner because I really want to get drunk. I knew it wouldn't help and all that. But, you know, the big, and then another big thing was in the Navy one time. I didn't, for the first time in my life, I didn't get a career, advanced in my career. And I blamed it all on my skipper and the XO. And they'd be out playing golf and I was making myself physically sick, you know, because I wouldn't accept it. And but the big things, you know, I really wasn't tempted to drink. But I think Bill's talking about the little things. And unfortunately, in the time Monty and I both have over 40 years of sobriety, we've known each other for over 30 years. We both kind of claim our home group is the Easy Does It Riders, which is a group. It's definitely not a motorcycle club. It's definitely not a club. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. We even had one guy who liked to come to our meetings and tell us we were crazy for riding motorcycles, but he was perfectly welcome. And anyways, I'm bringing up that we've had that time of sobriety because, unfortunately, in my time in sobriety, I know two guys personally who were active in the program, seemed to be doing good, and this one had well over 40 years, and he shot himself. You know, he just shot himself. And I know one other guy in the program who shot himself was working a program. And, you know, so it is serious. And I think personally, the danger is if you get to have a lot of sobriety, and our previous Paul mentioned it a little bit, you know, you kind of think, well, I'm supposed to be well, you know, and don't accept it when things are bothering you. I think it's dangerous when when long-term sobriety and somebody comes up to you and says, how you doing? You automatically say, I'm fine, you know, or Bobby Earle, one of our speakers passed away, that I really used to love listening to. He talks about you come to a wall and a newcomer will get back and run at the wall with all the energy he can and try to break through that wall, where maybe an old timer might just sit in front of the wall and not turn left or right, you know? And I think the danger is if not telling somebody, hey, I'm not feeling good, not because I've got a lot of sobriety. And, you know, eventually that's going to get us really in trouble. What else I want to say? And then 6 years later, or 4 years later, Bill wrote some more about emotional sobriety. And he wrote it in the article in this book was in the Grapevine on acceptance, you know. And I think basically when collectively all Bill's saying is acceptance is a really big part of this thing, you know, accept, and it's God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And of course, as somebody said earlier already, you know, it doesn't mean I have to like it, but I can separate maybe a little bit of what God's will for me is and what's happening, and they don't have to be the same all the time. But accept myself and accept that I don't know what I thought I'd be like with over 40 years of sobriety. My wife has also, we both have 45 years, and I can tell you it's sometimes we don't act like people with about 90 years of sobriety between us. And, you know, but it's what it is. Anyway, Bill, another thing he said, he says the kind of and this is in his thing on acceptance, the kind of acceptance and faith is capable of producing 100% sobriety. In fact, it usually does, and it must, or else we die. You know, the bottom line is, if I drink, you know, I don't know what I don't have a choice, and I believe this program has saved my life. If I went back to drinking, it could cost me my life. But the moment we carry these attitudes into our emotional problems, we find that the only relative results are possible. Nobody can, for example, become completely free from fear, anger, and pride. Hence, in this life, we shall attain nothing like perfect humility and love. Therefore, our first problem is to accept our present circumstances as they are, and ourselves as we are, and the people about us as they are. This is an exercise in acceptance that we can profitably practice every day of our lives, provided we strenuously avoid turning these realistic surveys of facts of life into unrealistic alibis. And then he goes on to talk a bit more about some of the other ways that Bill Wilson found to deal with emotional. Again, that was 4 years, so 28 years of sobriety or so. Let's see what else I want to say. Yeah, and so I thought, you know, when we were talking about doing this, and Monty and I, like I say, we've gone on a lot of motorcycle rides together and a lot of meetings and roundups, and we've discussed a lot, and this was one of the things that we've talked about, emotional sobriety in this. So when this, when acceptance is the key for this roundup, this just seemed like a good fit. So, let me see. Oh, and especially another reason I thought it'd be appropriate to do this. I was kidding about this being the southernmost city in Canada, but we get a lot of visitors from Canada and retired or semi-retired, and so we get a lot of people with long-term sobriety here, which is a real blessing. Hopefully some of the thoughts I put out can help somebody. As always, when you do something for AA, I know I'm going to get something out of doing it. So with that, I am going to introduce my friend Monty, has a lot more to add. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. My name is Monty. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is Thanksgiving 1981. Talking to Rick about this, you know, why did he pick me, number one? Do I need it? Because he thinks I have some, right? When you ride motorcycles with people, you find out if they have a program real quick when they have flat tires and credit cards and rainstorms and hail and missed reservations. And then we got Easy Does It all over our backs, and then we tear through town wondering what that looks like to the rest of the population. But like he said, it is a group. It's an AA group. We go by the traditions. You remember when you say you are. We had a guy named Bones for the longest time that was like the best ambassador for AA in general and for the Easy Does It riders. He would go up to everybody and invite them. It's not any kind of motorcycle, including scooters. It's been an interesting bunch. Because Bones invited everybody. Bones made you feel welcome. He was like the most accepting, welcoming person I ever met. Because he's my sponsor, I thought I'd be like that too. But he was always surrounded by these people that had been sober a long time and weren't having a good time. And I called them honorary old timers. There was this guy, he says, I've been drunk 4 days in the last 22 years. I said, well, how long you got now? He says, I've been drunk 4 days in the last 22 years. So those people gravitated to Bones. He loved everybody and everybody loved him. But he only made it to 35 years. Bill Wilson made it to 36. Dr. Bob only made it to 15. There isn't a timeline for where you should be at a certain amount of sobriety. We have 65 years here, or 66 maybe now. I have a friend in Santee who's 62 years sober. And I love the humility the guy has. He says, I've stayed sober 62 years on a very mediocre program. And, you know, a lot of us come to these kinds of roundups and conventions to recharge our batteries and to get reinvigorated. And usually we talk about being of more service and carrying the message better. And so to tell Frank about what AA was like in LA 60 years ago and to be really human, you know, when he stubs his toe, he hurts. And when things don't go his way, he gets angry. And but that, along with Bones, right? Bones didn't put any, I first saw God in Bones' eyes. See, I told him, I'm going to do something. He said, great. A little while later, I said, things have changed. I'm not going to do it. And he said, great. And he loved me unconditionally. And what is missing from, you know, if the opposite of addiction is connection, and the ladies and gentlemen that talked about acceptance previously talked about feeling separate, feeling different, and finding a place to feel comfortable in your own skin. And I think the program of recovery is a way to do that, the 12 steps and the rest of our lifestyle. But the opposite of addiction is connection. But you can be X number of years sober and still feel disconnected. He's talking about our own personal experience. I don't know if you've ever thought you want to fire all your friends and get some new ones, but there was a time when I knew that I could not live without this program, and I didn't feel welcome here, and I didn't know where I was going to fit in, and it became important to me at that time to put my hand out, to be the person I wanted to meet in a meeting, to make myself available for people. And then the bad news, like Rick was talking about, if you go to YouTube and you listen to Jim Burwell, he is at least two talks on there. And because he was around when they wrote the book, people love to hear the history of AA from him. So he tells you what it was like, how it was gross exaggeration to say 100 people, that there might have been 40 that were sober and 60 that were in and out. And then he talks about, of those 40, right, where did the numbers come from in that forward to the second edition? He says, of those 40, 20 stayed sober, and 10 were in and out, but eventually achieved sobriety. And then the other 25%, the other 10, their lives might have been enriched or lengthened because of their association with this program. But then he goes on to talk about, of the 20 that stayed sober, 6 of them died by their own hand. That's a lot. And so even though depression is like the other side of the coin for sobriety, and Bill W. struggled with it, and some of us do too, but because we agree on how to get sober, but we don't agree on how to stay sober, there isn't a direct line about how to treat depression. So I talk about, of course, I thought when I have a bunch of time, right, I thought at 20 years, you should have a PhD or at least a master's in codependence and in depression. But since we don't give advice, I didn't realize you have to suffer from that in order to talk about it. And the thing for me, it was my emotions that got me into AA. It was my emotions that kept me in AA, because I was 26 years old and I hadn't lost hardly anything. I should have drank myself out of the Navy. But they saved my career and got me sober at the same time. But I come into AA, and their favorite thing to share is all the stuff they lost, you know, and wives and houses and jobs. And I didn't always relate to that. I had a little voice that said, listen up, same disease. But I didn't always relate to everything you lost. But then when you got around to how you felt about your bosses, how you felt about your spouses, how you felt about your jobs, about how you felt about the other drivers on the freeway, I could relate. So it was in those emotions that I found a home here in Alcoholics Anonymous. But the thing with battling my own depression is that I was in and out of therapy, and I ended up being diagnosed clinically with depression at 12 years sober. And the shrink that did it, he says, I think you've been depressed since the age of 6. He says, are you sure you don't want to kill yourself? I never had the thought. Okay, but so that's how depressed he thought I was, and he was amazed. But see, the other thing I am besides sick is stubborn. Okay? Like, the way I earned my seat here, I didn't like AA. I did not want this to be my solution. I didn't get why we worked the steps. And it seemed like it was full of gray hair and cigarette smoke. And, you know, I wasn't interested. But I went, the big book says a real alcoholic can't go a year without drinking. So I said, ha-ha. All right, there's my out. Right? I'm not just sick, I'm stubborn too. Right? So I go a year without drinking. I end up with a knot in my gut that bugs me 24 hours a day. I'm on leave from work. If I got money in the bank, if I'm not fighting with the old lady, I have this knot in my gut. So since booze isn't my problem anymore, I'm going to go get some help for this anxiety, and I'll be good. But the therapist I went to, he says, well, you consider yourself alcoholic and that you should not drink. I said, that's right. He says, well, I won't work with an alcoholic that doesn't have a maintenance program, and I suggest you go back to AA. So I come back, taking everybody's inventory, noting all the differences between you and me, so I can tell this guy he's wrong. I've already been here. You know, it ain't here for me. And this little woman gets up at the old El Cajon Alano Club, the one that burned down, and she says she's alcoholic and her obsession to drink has been removed. And zoom, my inventory taken mine's right in on her. She's either lying about being alcoholic or she's lying about the obsession being removed. Because if I had heard that, it had not registered. But it really got my attention. And I met my Eskimo. He sent me to a men's meeting where I met Bones. He sent me, and I saw him at that men's meeting once. He sent me to a step study that I never saw him at. And then I got hooked up with the guys that rode motorcycles sober and been around ever since. So when they diagnosed me with depression, I had some like work trauma to go with it. So, because normally a shrink will give you pills because they can, and a psychologist will give you therapy because they can't give pills, okay? So this guy is a shrink. He puts me on the pills, but he also, to get desensitized, he sends me to a psychologist. And the psychologist told me about cognitive distortions, okay? That maybe there's something wrong with the way we think, right? Or the way I think, right? Because I have to own this, because this isn't AA approved. This isn't conference approved, but so when he first did that, this was the list. And this is 15 of them. They've since added. There's now 22. But the first one is filtering. You take negative details and magnify them and filter out positive aspects. Okay? Nobody in here does that, right? Okay? So, but, you know, I really, for me, half the key of staying sober is staying grateful. And the glass is half full, even if it really looks like there ain't much left. You know, that I have to stay positive. The 12 and 12 says in step two, it says one of the definitions of insanity is we replaced positive thinking with negative thinking. So then the next one is polarized thinking, which you guys can guess is black or white, all or nothing. Right? Because we don't like gray. We don't like uncertain. I don't. Overgeneralization. Mind reading. Without saying, we think we know what other people are thinking and feeling and why they're doing what they're doing. Catastrophizing. Expecting disaster. Personalization. That somehow I'm responsible for this. Right? Because I was an irresponsible drunk and I went to being an overly responsible sober person. I went from nothing is my fault to everything is my fault. And I fretted about the whole works. And control fallacies. The biggest one, of course, is that the way I treat other people is the way they should treat me. And that's not an agreement that everybody's ever made with me. So I really have to accept you for you and just take care of my own self and keep my side of the street clean. And it's the fallacy of fairness, wanting life to be fair. And life isn't fair. Life is life. Sometimes I win, right? They used to say, sometimes you hug the bear, sometimes the bear hugs you. So I call that I win some and I lose some. But and sometimes we're going to talk real briefly about when the really bad things happen. Because like people talked earlier about losing a child and losing a career. And, you know, the big book says we cause our own problems. So, but if you stay sober long enough, something's going to happen to you or to someone you care about that you didn't cause, that they didn't cause, that you don't deserve, that they don't deserve, right? The one line that catches the catch-all in the big book is God is everything or God is nothing, right? Because we think God is positive, God is life, right? The Hindus crack me up because they have three gods. They have the creator, the maintainer, and the destroyer. And the destroyer is the one they venerate the most because nothing real can be destroyed. So everything about truth and purity is done by that Shiva, by that destruction. So the blaming, right? That I'm, you know, I don't have a problem. Started with my drinking. You have a problem. Leave me alone. We won't have a problem. And shoulds, right? I will not should on myself today. And for me, switch should, which is negative and judgmental, to could. Yeah, I could have done that. I might do that next time. But not feeling bad about myself. Then this is my favorite. It's called emotional reasoning. And if you hang out with cognitive people, they say the thought comes first, and then your feelings react to the thoughts. But non-dual people think that the feeling comes first, and then we rationalize it or think of a reason that we're feeling that way. Because when I was depressed, I would feel bad, so I would think of a reason I was bad. And I had what John Bradshaw calls a collage of shameful memories. And it was wasn't just one of them. It was one, and then two, and then three, and then four. And it was on me like a wet blanket. So I'm a throat cancer survivor. I'm not in any pain, but I do live with a sore throat, so I apologize for coughing. So the fallacy of change, expecting other people will change to suit you, right? That's crazy, but we do it. Global labeling, you generalize one or two qualities in yourself or others into a negative global judgment, right? Being right, you feel continually on trial to prove that your opinions and actions are correct. Being wrong is unthinkable. See, now, that's, for me, that goes back to my childhood when it wasn't okay to be wrong. The right person's the winner and the wrong person's the loser, okay? The other thing I had with my childhood is only the biggest person in the situation is allowed to be angry. So I grew up waiting for when it was my turn to be the one to be angry. And I was, and I did. And so, you know, that's part of what got me here, right? It's some people tell you I'm supposed to talk about what it was like, what happened and what it is like now. But the book actually says what I was like. So it's how was I feeling and what happened and how do I feel now based on that. And then heaven's reward fallacy, right? The big one for drunks is I've been sober this long, I deserve to get drunk. But anytime I'm thinking that I've earned something, that I've deserved something, the 12 and 12 says we get afraid because we lose something we have or we're not getting something we think we demand, right? And I'm not a demanding person. I'm a deserving person. So that, and a friend of mine, I wanted to slap him. He says, oh, you have a problem with entitlement. And okay, I do, obviously. But so, you know, with cognitive therapy, you look at how you think. And if you ever have the right therapist, for me, it's a reality check. It's another set of eyes. Because I always thought therapy was only for crazy people. So I was wrong about that. I also thought my childhood was normal. Until I found out, you know, what raises well-balanced people compared to how I was raised. I was raised by substance abuse and depression. So, but when I did my childhood work, I had to look at what their childhoods were like too. And I found out they did better for us than was done for them. My mom was in and out of an orphanage. My dad was babysitting his drunk father on a ranch in Colorado while his mom and his sisters lived in town because she was a nurse. And both of my parents joined the Navy at 17 to get away from home. Imagine that. And Rick was talking about the letter that Bill wrote. And my buddy Frank, he's 62 years sober, he talks about old-timers with their heads in the oven. And it says here, oldsters lack emotional sobriety. It says, the spearhead of the next major development will be the development of more maturity, balance, and to say humility. So for me, humility is just honesty. But what it was Rick was talking about was staying transparent, really letting people know what's going on with me. When I tell people I didn't get honest till I was 20 years sober, their heads whip around. But it's that peeling of the onion thing. There was stuff I wasn't ready to look at. And it came up at my wife's 40th birthday party. I have a sober angel. She's 34 years sober. Her happy place is in her house with her cat and her dog in her craft room. So she's not with us this weekend. But I'm the traveler, so I get to come and see you guys and share with you guys. So life is good. But the... Where was I going with that? Oh, her 40th birthday party. So one of my sponsees shows up late, and he shows up with a guy I don't like, and the guy's got these popper things, and the restaurant doesn't like him because they make a little noise and make a big mess. And so we're in the Chinese restaurant. There's about 20 of us. And so I asked the guy, why is he late? And he says, well, because I was with so-and-so, which isn't a good reason. So I went off on him. And they calmed me down, and they calmed him down, and they smoothed it over. My wife was, or my sponsor was there, and some other senior people, members of our group. And but I left that meeting, I left that dinner pounding on the steering wheel, because we had a lady who used to go off on people. And I won't tell you her name. I liked her because she always shared that she never wanted to drink like a lady. She wanted to drink like a pig and act like a lady. So I liked her. I liked her a lot. But she could be obnoxious. So I was thinking, you know, I need to do something else, right? What I've done to this point, I need to do something else. And a lady friend of mine and I are looking for a double winner Al-Anon meeting. And by the time we find it, we're going to be late. And I don't like being late the first time to a meeting, so we sit in her car and talk. And she was explaining to me that in a previous life, she had had a rich lesbian girlfriend, and they could do anything they wanted to do, go to any kind of therapy they wanted to go to. And there's this lady that had these five-day intensives, therapy intensives. At that time, this was 20 years ago, they cost $1,500. That's a lot of money. But now they're $2,000 and you do them online. So, but that's still a lot of money. But this therapy that she did was very spiritual. She says, you allow yourself to feel whatever you need to feel, and you open yourself up to spiritual guidance about how you should handle your affairs and what I call feel, heal, and deal. You know, because if I'm not honest about how I feel, we can't even start. So, but I'm not always proud of how I feel. So sometimes it takes a little humility to admit that something bugged me. But inner bonding opened my heart. But it didn't entirely fix my depression. But there's these non-duality teachers like Eckhart Tolle and Ajahn Shanti and Muji and Gangaji, and those are the big ones. There's a bunch of little ones, but they all handle the feelings exactly the same way. They all say, sit with it. They all say, when you're sad, be sad. But the key to that is to allow yourself to have the feeling without telling the story about it. See, the root of the word resent means to re-feel, right? It isn't just you did something to me, and it isn't just that I'm not happy with the way I responded, but I replay it in my head, and you get wronger and wronger, and I get righter and righter. And I can do that with resentments, I can do it with shame, I can do it with blame, that circular thinking. So what short-circuits that is when I allow myself to sit with a feeling. Maybe not even label it. Just, you know, this is an energy in my body. And allow it to be there as long as it needs to be there without even an agenda to have it go away. And when I do that, there is always something underneath. For me, it was anger first, right? And underneath the anger was the fear. And underneath the fear was the hurt. And underneath the hurt was the loneliness. And underneath the loneliness was a horrible sadness. I look back and my mom didn't know what to do with me. She'd leave me crying in the crib, is what I found out later. John Bradshaw calls that a ruptured self. When I heard that, I thought, that's awfully dramatic, you know, a ruptured self. But if you don't feel good about yourself, that's like the worst kind of, you know, who taught us we needed to be different in order to be loved, right? For most of us, it's our parents. And, you know, you get here and you get sober, and it's a God-shaped hole, and then you get so far, and then you got to go to therapy, and then it's a parent-shaped hole, and then eventually it's a U-shaped hole, because those people aren't here anymore. It's you doing it to you, or it's me doing it to me. So what happened, my depression was a belief system that I was crap, my life was crap, and it was always going to be that way. And I had to feel safe enough to feel the sadness, to feel all those feelings and see what was underneath. And I had to train my mind to look for the good stuff. Because when you're depressed and you're expecting bad things to happen, I could find them, right? It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. What I look for, I find. So I had to look for the good stuff, retrain my mind to at least be balanced, if not a little bit, the glass is half full, you know, a little biased. And then what's interesting is that underneath the feelings that come and go, which are generally called bad, sadness, fear, hurt, anger, there's always an undercurrent to that. And that's what those people like Ajahn Chah and Eckhart Tolle are talking about. When you get that honest with your feelings, that honest with your experience, it opens you up to something else. I had that experience. So, because my therapy is very spiritual and my spirituality is very therapeutic. So, to close, what I call sobriety 911, okay? What I have to look out for, though, besides people with their heads in the oven, is I've been sober too long to feel this way. Okay, I call that the kiss of death. And then too many years and not enough days, right? I get focused on the negative, I get resentments, fear comes back. That one day at a time thing kind of slips away and I'm not so happy. Not so comfortable. But then, to combat that, to go back to Bill's letter about humility and about love, is I need a deeper surrender. Always a deeper surrender. I'm arguing with reality. I'm arguing with my Creator. And then, I need a drink. So get a bigger God. So deeper surrender, number one, get a bigger God, right? Because generally I'm relying on my resources. When I'm wondering where God is, it's because I've taken back over the show. asking for help without knowing what the help's going to look like, which is generally just being honest, you know, just letting somebody know I'm not as happy as I'd, you know. But I say that I would like to normalize reading page 133 in the big book. That's a page where it talks about happy, joyous, and free. Then it talks about depression not going away. Then it talks about outside help, about good doctors and good psychologists. And because if you're doing everything we say to do, and you're not happy, joyous, and free, maybe you need some more help. So, you know, that's why if I do emotional sobriety, and I couldn't nail Rick down about what he wanted to do with this, and panels are normally four people, not two. So, but I'm not in charge. So, I you know, if I have to apologize to you, I will. But because I have, I get to share my experience, strength, and hope about my emotional sobriety, I think is why he picked me. So I want to thank you very much. A deeper surrender, a bigger God, ask for help without knowing what it's going to look like, to be as willing to change as I was when I was new, because I can get really rigid after I've been here a while, and resentments come back, because now it's the right kind of resentments, because me and God are both pissed, you know? So, and then last one, this is the hardest one, turn to you. Turn a humiliating experience into a humbling experience, because that makes it okay. So, it's 15:43, it's 3:43. We're supposed to use an hour. I want to ask if anybody has any questions for Rick or myself. And we actually have a microphone. And our lovely assistant, Lori, if somebody wants to ask a question. Bonk. I'm going to assume I did such a great job. That's why there are no questions. But probably what happened is I gave you something to think about. And hopefully made you more comfortable in your own skin. So, okay, Michael.
Hello. That was excellent. Thank you, Rick. Thank you, Monty. And I know you both. What is your morning meditation look like? And when you wake up and you are feeling depressed, how do you break the cycle?
You know, I used to come to meetings for the humor. I used to come to meetings to hear the laughter. I was stubborn. Now, though, thank you for your question, Michael. Now, I don't wake up bummed out anymore. I wake up grateful to have woke up. You know, I really try to stay grateful for every breath. And for, like we like to brag about, for waking up instead of coming to. But I have shortened my morning meditation is what can I do for the people that still suffer, which is right out of page 164. And my combination of the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer is I give it all to you. Just show me what you would have me do. So that's a great question. Anybody else? Go.
Thank you for the question, Mike. On the meditation, my wife and I get up and we do a little reading, and then we do a little meditation, and then we have a list of people we pray for. And one of the keys that I try to work on is to do that before I get on my iPhone. You know. It's first things first and priorities, but that doesn't always happen. But the other question was, when I'm feeling really down or something, you know, Bill's solution was to get more active, and that helps for sure. But for some of the things I personally do is I really try to make a gratitude list. If it's something I'm really worried about, I sometimes limit it down to, you know, just for today. Today's going to be all fine. That thing I'm worried about may happen in the future, but today is okay, you know? And but that also includes doing the footwork. If there's something I can do about it, do it. And then, you know, I kind of, over the years, I've kind of got, once I've done the footwork, anything beyond that is just beating myself up and worry. It's non-productive, you know. So gratitude, doing one day at a time. And but I think for me anyway, the main thing that I read in Bill's thing is, just because you got a lot of time, don't be afraid to admit today isn't good. I'm not in a good spot, you know, because again, alcoholism, you don't have to drink for the disease to kill you, you know, that's the bottom line. And so for me, that's the main message I think Bill was putting out and I'm putting out, or that I've heard is, you know, I don't have to pretend everything is great when it's not. And I won't use that other acronym for fine that I'm sure we've all heard. Thank you. Monty, take it back for questions.
Anybody else? Lori, there's a hand over here. Well, we're recording it also.
I just texted. How about that one? I just Googled Emotional Anonymous. There is meetings out there, and I know some people who attended meetings, but I wondered, do they have a central office and all that good stuff, or is that, I mean, I guess I could find it, but there's so many meetings out there, and it's hard to keep them going. People lose interest in them and whatnot. Thank you.
Thank you. Bill actually thought we'd have a Neurotics Anonymous, where you would catalog your losses in life. We have one more, please.
I was about 10 years sober, and I read Bradshaw's book, and the more I read, the more messed up I got. And I was trying to get to the healing part, but I got the 12-gauge out instead. And the next thing I thought of was call your sponsor. And he told me, put the book down, quit reading it, and I'll be there in an hour. And I really appreciate and love sponsorship, because he saved my life. Then he told me, he said, there's another guy out there named Ernie Larson. He doesn't take the quite rough approach as John Bradshaw does, and it really helped me. But I couldn't tell people that I was hurting for that reason. I've been sober X amount of years, and I don't want to see him say me broken. And it didn't matter. I felt safe with my sponsor. And thank God for him, the relationship we had. When he told me that we were going to have intimacy, I thought we were going to have relations. And he said, no, no. He said, intimacy is into me, you see.
Love that.
And I thought, wonderful. I'd really didn't want to get naked with him anyway. But anyway, that's all I have to say.
Thank you for that. Ernie Larson, thank you. Ernie Larson wrote books like Stage 2 Recovery, Stage 2 Relationships, and then his latest book is called A Healer's Way. But none of that is conference approved. Anybody else? But I do want to thank you for giving us this opportunity and for listening as politely as you have. Because this isn't always stuff you're going to hear all the time. And you'll find people that'll tell you, I'm not alcoholic because my dad put me on the potty backwards. And, you know, if you want to change the way you feel, have a cup of coffee. So, but some of us, like there was a lady in Laughlin, she had 40 years of sobriety, and she says, I think 10% of drunks need therapy. I said, yeah, I think 10% don't and 80% are in denial. So But if I've encouraged you to look at something, if I've made it okay for you to feel a certain way, then the book says that it's a spiritual solution. The 12 and 12 says that God is our safest reliance. And, you know, the quality of my sobriety is proportional to the quality of my surrender. And the big book says we quit fighting, right? I quit arguing with my Creator. And we wouldn't talk so much about acceptance if it was easy. It's always hard. It's always accepting the unacceptable. That thing that Dr. Paul wrote, 449, now 417, there's a line in there that a lot of people have a problem with. It says nothing happens by mistake. Because of those horrible things I was talking about. But notice it doesn't say by accident. It says by mistake. And that's hindsight. I know it was supposed to happen because it did happen. I may not like that it happened, but what am I going to do now? That's real acceptance. That's real faith. And like I said, when those things happened to me, I had to redo the third step. Because they said my will is my thinking and my life is my actions. So I had to turn the third step around. When I make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of a power greater than myself or God as I understand God, that my will is me and my life is everything that happens to me. Is that God is everything or God is nothing? God set up this whole game, including cancer, including terrorism, including drunk drivers. But what that does is it's not God's not doing things to me. God is available to get us through it, right? Instead of doing it to me, God is available to help me get through it. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much for all listening. And again, you know, this is just sharing our experience and, you know, what's helped us and what's worked for you. And I always think of take what you want and leave the rest, you know, if it helped you. Okay, before I close, the next